when you stop designing that way and you start looking into the smaller components of the city, this is why I say that I'm a recovering architect, because I don't do what the mainstream architecture does.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 3 of Damn the Absolute. There is a strong tension between localism or place and the overwhelming forces of globalism. We might say that in addition to living in the information age, that we find ourselves right in the middle of the age of mass scale. We see this in pop culture, mass media, globalizing economies, and even in expanding bureaucratic governments. There are certainly advantages that come with scaling up. These include efficiency and tapping into previously unknown capabilities. But there are also cultural and social costs that come with orienting ourselves toward large-scale solutions. This becomes quite apparent when we consider urbanism, architecture, and the ways in which we design our cities, and all the more tangible when examining the role storefronts play in our communities. Today, I'm speaking with Jaime Isorieta. A town planner and urban designer by training, Jaime is the founder of Storefront Mastery, a creative agency that brings beauty to local economic development. Put simply, Jaime helps local economies by creating the optimal setting for people to fall in love with their particular places. He advocates buying locally and designing cities around smaller nodes where he believes urban life actually happens. But he also acknowledges the fantastic power that larger scales can offer us. Now, how do we balance the advantages of mass scale with the unique benefits of having an eye toward the local? What is placemaking, and why does it matter so much? How will the pandemic change urban life and the ways in which we design our cities and communities going forward? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Jaime, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I'd like to just jump off with a question on beliefs or viewpoints. What's a view you've held in adulthood that you were really certain wouldn't change that's actually changed significantly for you?
Well, I would have to say children. until I was like 39, I never thought of that. Had my child when I was 40. So I guess it's a sea change. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's one view that it may seem very not transcendental right now when I tell you, but really it changes your view of everything. It changes your perspective of the future. It's incredible how you start thinking of things that you were just completely passing over before, and it makes every decision that you make much more complex. So that it adds a layer of richness, let's say.
I am not a father or a parent, but I quite understand that sentiment from a lot of siblings and friends. It really just, you don't know until you're holding that child in your arms, and it just changes everything.
It does.
So Jaime, tell us a little bit more about yourself. Introduce us to you and then the work you're doing with Storefront Mastery.
I am originally from Ecuador, from the city of Quito, which is a very high city. It's almost 2 miles high. Which is interesting because we don't have much air. So we are used to breathing little air. And this apparently changes our whole perspective in the world. We are surrounded by mountains. So we do have limits to our thinking. And this is, again, it may seem like nothing, but having the limits that you can see and you can almost touch, it really marks you, as in it brings limits to what you do. And you are you have to consciously break those limits when you want to do something bigger than normal things.
I'm also someone from the mountains. My family are mostly from Utah. And so we've got our high elevation. Everyone lives in mountain valley. So I can resonate with some of the experience you're pointing out there.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. And so I am, by training, I am an architect. I went to school here, so I came to the US and I went to school in Georgia, in Savannah, which is a fantastic town. It was a perfect laboratory for what I was doing. I was being trained as an architect and as a historic preservationist. I have since recovered. And then I went back home and I spent a year in Holland doing city planning. And this was a different kind of city planning because it's a program geared towards people who work in local governments, international people who work in local governments. So the experience there with all my classmates who were coming from everywhere, really, people from Africa, from Indonesia, from China, from India, Bangladesh, and also here and South America. It was a super multicultural experience, which also adds lots of layers. And I started looking at storefronts because of various reasons, because I've always liked storefronts, because I've had a few jobs after I came back with a city planning, with urban planning master's degree. I had a few jobs that were looking at how the vertical sides of the sidewalk are impacting the sidewalk experience. So when you're forced to think of those things when you're doing a project, some of that thinking stays in the back of your head and forces you to look elsewhere to see what else is there. So storefronts for probably the last 15 years. And then I was fortunate that my family decided to open a bookstore. And I think bookstores are probably the noblest of storefronts, just because they offer people their own stories. It's not telling a story and trying to attract people, but having thousands of stories that people can choose. And so the interaction of the storefront with the people is really great.
Yeah, bookstores seem to almost always have the strongest storefronts in general when I'm walking around most towns.
Even bad bookstore storefronts are good storefronts. Because, I mean, if you have nothing, you just put a cart with books outside, the interaction that the people will have with that cart is amazing. So having the opportunity to design that and actually be hands-on in the design and the building of this storefront was a great experience. And so when I progressed on my urban planning jobs, I just kept coming in contact with storefronts. So I decided 2 years ago to write a book about design of storefronts. And this is a longish format book that explains all the rules and the necessary things that you need to create a great storefront. And then after the pandemic, I was trying to come up with a tool or a playbook that would allow the small business owners to get a little bit of perspective, because I saw that the anxiety that they were having because they had to close for 2 weeks, but it wasn't 2 weeks. It kept you know, being longer. Mm-hmm. And they saw no end to this. And so many were closing and so many were having this anxiety because of money, because of being closed, because of not knowing when they would be able to open. And so I created this tool to help them with the anxiety. And this has all evolved from the original ebook about storefronts and this anti-anxiety tool. It evolved into what I think is a great tool to create a storefront from scratch. What I want, the final aim is to have this simplified so much that any storefront or business owner can just purchase it and implement themselves. And of course, not have to pay all the fees for the design of a storefront, which are pretty hefty. So yeah, that's what I'm doing right now with Storefront Mastery.
So with the work you're doing, you're in part a consulting agency for some typically smaller businesses. The hire out, what does that look like? So if someone doesn't want to just do just the book and it's like, I need a lot more help here, what do I do?
Yeah, it's a consulting agency. It's a creative agency that the primary client is a downtown association, a local organization, a Main Street or a BID, Business Improvement District. And what they do is they kind of broker the interaction between maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 20 businesses and me, and I do this workshop in which I coach them through the playbook. So that's the primary thing. And then, of course, there's the individual thing in which this is the same system that I use with my clients. So when I have a client with whom we're designing their storefront, I use the same tools. It's an interview, questions that I ask them about about different topics and different areas of their business, not only the storefront design, but different areas of the business. And then they have a canvas which they fill themselves with keywords and key answers from these questions. And then there's the actual design. They can create the mood, they can find their happy place, what inspires them to create the design of the store, and then the checklist. So if they want an awning, they go to the awning part of the checklist and they know what they need. They need to look at the materials, they need to look at the structure, need to look at the color, need to look at the branding, etc. It's exactly the same tool that I use with my clients, but simplified so anybody can use it without the designer. And if they need it, my email is there so they can reach out and I'll help.
You mentioned earlier that I believe the words you used were a recovering architect.
I did.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yes. When you get trained as an architect, you get trained as somebody who imposes their view. So you are standing in front of three architects, usually your professor, some other professor, and some hotshot that they brought from a local firm. And you have to justify what you've just designed to them. And they grill you with really hard questions and questioning the integrity of your project. And you get a thick skin when you go 5 years of doing this. And you end up thinking that you can justify anything. And paper, you can do anything to paper. You can draw anything in paper. And you can justify it in front of three people, but then try to build it. And we do. We do. And we force these unnatural designs into cities. And it's not like I design a poster or I paint a picture. And if you don't like it, you turn around and you keep going. Mm-hmm. If you have a library like the one you have locally, you have no option but to look at that horrible thing. It may be a fantastic library, which I think it is, but it's a horrible building. It's a horrible building that takes the entire block with one entrance. And when you want to go to the library, you need to walk by these horrible blank walls that are sending you a message of doom and gloom. And we architects do that. When somebody is an architect and discovers this very tiny scale in which the city actually functions, because the city doesn't function in this huge scale like the Seattle Library or like the Cooper Union building in New York, for example, which are buildings that take the entire block with one entrance and drab walls around. You start discovering that the actual city functions in an 8-foot storefront where a tailor is, or a shoe repair, or a little convenience store, or a small coffee shop that's tucked underneath a gym. And you see these small wonders that actually make up the city, and you start questioning the dumb scale in which you were designing before. So when you stop designing that way and you start looking into the smaller components of the city, this is why I say that I'm a recovering architect, because I don't do what the mainstream architecture does.
What are some of these incentives or reasons why this viewpoint you have on architecture, that there's this push for large scale, you talk about like imposing one's worldview onto communities. Why is that so strong amongst contemporary architects?
I think it's the way we're trained. I'm going to refer to Le Corbusier and shift all the blame into him. Yes, I will. It's probably a cliche, but let's say that he embodies the zeitgeist of the early 20th.
Who is this? Who did you say, Jaime?
What? Who did I say? Embodied? I said Le Corbusier.
Okay.
Le Corbusier is this Swiss-French architect who authored a book that's called Towards a New Architecture. And in that book, he set all the concepts and the ideas that would later be the basic catalog of modernist architecture, which was written down in what we now know as the Athens Charter. Yeah, the Athens Charter. And this is This is a book that he wrote on a boat going from France in the Mediterranean to Athens with a few of his friends. And it was the Modernist Manifesto, basically. It was the Charter of Athens, in which efficiency is number one, cleaning up architecture. And if you look at the way the old buildings were configured, and if you look at cities as the breeding grounds of everything that's wrong with society and public health and in the interaction between people, you tend to look at these buildings that were at that point, I don't know, 200, 300 maybe even years old. And of course, they do not look new. And it's an easy target to blame this very dense urban configuration, which were the European cities at the time, and start coming up with ideas, clean them up, to break down the centers. And so the basic proposal of Le Corbusier was to demolish the entire Marais district in Paris and build these huge towers that were separated probably 100 meters from each other. That would be like 300 feet from each other, because they would have a lot of air, they would have a lot of light. And these are very noble intentions. Mm-hmm. But then you look at what happens at the street level, and this is the same that I was saying before. When you start looking at the actual components of how the city works, and you have the shoe shine or the shoe repair and the tailor and the convenience store and the I don't know, TV repair. And these are places that have, I don't know, maybe 100, maybe 200 square feet. And you compare this to the footprint of a huge building that has 10,000 square feet. It's a completely different scale. So the way people interact in front of the little storefronts and the way people interact in front of these huge places, huge buildings that also need to be very set back from the sidewalks, it basically breaks the elemental components of how people interact in the city. And people don't see limits. I was talking about the limits, the natural limits that the mountains impose on you. Not having legible limits also when you're in a public space makes the public space harder for you to interact with it. And then also people, since they also cannot interact with the public space well, they cannot interact among them well. It makes the public spaces very hard to read. It makes the public spaces very hard to inhabit. And so it makes the public spaces dead. You walk by these huge plazas that have no limits and you feel like they are dead. And you walk into the typical squares of the European cities and they are tiny and you feel welcome. You feel contained. You feel, and I think this is a very important concept, the containment. When a baby is born, the mother grabs the baby and holds the baby very close to her bosom, and this is containment. When the person feels contained, the person feels like structure is forming, and it happens the same with public spaces that do not have the ability to contain. There's no structure for the interaction that happens in there.
Yeah, there's this very real contrast where you talked about like these large scale structures or massive plazas that, because there's not a limit, there is the sense of not being able to familiarize yourself, where you're in a small store. There's a sense in which there's just a handful of people, and maybe it's a store that you tend to go to. You start to know the owner, you know the regular people who come in, and there's this reasonable scale for you to comprehend it. We're in the information age, or maybe the mass scale age, where everything is so big and it's beyond our human ability to fully comprehend it. And part of us to cope with that, we just sort of shut down. I think of when every time I go to New York City, for example, it takes a little bit of time to adjust because there's so much stimulus and so much a massive scale that you have to learn to shut down parts of yourself and what you're processing, because it's overwhelming. Yes. And I think those all come together with this massive scale that you're talking about.
Part of it is the system that requires efficiency. There's a lot of us. And to be able to give a good enough service to so many of us, you need to scale up. So if you have 8 million residents in New York City, or if you have 2 million residents in Seattle, you need to have, for example, an electric company that's big enough to provide to everybody. And as the company grows, it needs more people, it needs more departments, it needs more trucks, and it needs many, many things that do not scale. So you cannot have a huge truck. You need to have 10 trucks, right? So as the companies keep growing to provide services, the corporations, let's say, government, company, nonprofit, anything, any corporation grows to provide a service to lots of people, there are some things that do not scale. For example, your house, as somebody who is providing the service, the house will not change. If you have a huge house, you'll have a, let's say, a 15,000 square foot house. And then my house, which is like 600 square feet, my apartment. We still have that little pipe where the cables are inside and they are coming to the house. Mm-hmm. And the service is being provided in the same way to this huge mansion and to my tiny apartment. So some things do not scale. When the corporations start getting too big, they focus on efficiency. They focus on efficiency, so they need to provide 1,000 units of whatever. Those 1,000 units, they may not be the perfect units, but they are 1,000 because you have 1,000 clients. When you are thinking of the cobbler, the cobbler may take 3 weeks to make your pair of shoes because that's the pair of shoes that he's making, and it will be a fantastic pair of shoes. And it will be a work of art because he's making one. So that's the fundamental difference. So when corporations get too big, they start being about the finances. When corporations are not big, they are about the real estate. So they can be local. They can cater to the local. When they start growing, they need to stop catering to the local. They need to be larger and larger every time because that's how they achieve their efficiency.
What are some more of the social or cultural costs that come from either architecture scaling up too big or corporations becoming too large or maybe even government entities becoming too large? What are those costs that we experience?
I think the first one is a fundamental gap between the ability to comprehend your immediate surroundings and the inability to fathom the size of any action that a big corporation does. So let's take, for example, the CARES Act, the stimulus of the pandemic. We are speaking of $2.5 trillion. And now everybody speaks about $2.5 trillion. Do you have any idea how much that is? I don't have an idea how much that is. The idea that I do have is that my neighbor who has a bakery needs $25,000. That I can imagine, $25,000. That is going to get him through the winter. That is going to allow him to pay his rent and to pay the salary of the bakers who work with him and to keep the doors open. $25,000. Versus $2.5 trillion, which I cannot even imagine. So the difference in scale is, and these are people, the thing that doesn't scale is people. People are making this decision about $2.5 trillion, and people are trying to get the $25,000 to cope for the winter. It's the same people, it's the same scale of people, same size of people. It's just the decisions are just so huge that they do not scale. How do you bring $2.5 trillion into so many small businesses? You don't. You can't. This is why yesterday I was seeing this ad for, it was a private jet company that is offering a discount because basically with the CARES Act, you can have a discount on your excise tax. So they are offering a discount on the jets. But if you have a jet, can you imagine the income that you must have to be able to purchase a $30 million jet, mm-hmm. or at least a stake in a $30 million jet? So that is not a small business owner. A small business owner is my other neighbor who is elderly and works with his wife in a convenience store that says Jack's from 1950. and has, we are in the town of Buzz Aldrin. So he has pictures of Buzz Aldrin when he came back from the moon because he's a local. So that's the fundamental divide that we have when $2.5 trillion gets stuck somewhere because somebody is getting a discount on his Learjet versus somebody who actually needs $20,000 to make it through the winter.
Another idea on this tension that comes up in my mind a lot is the notion of what's been called the knowledge problem and the lack of access to local knowledge. That, for example, you and your neighbors, you know each other's businesses a lot more intimately and the needs of your community mm-hmm. than an entity, whether it's, for example, for me, a bunch of agents in Olympia for the state government versus me in my neighborhood or
correct.
Even more in Washington, D.C. And so when the scale gets so big, it's difficult. Humans, we don't scale up. And so there's this sense in which individual people are erased into this technical machine that's pumping out information to guide decisions, but that information is incomplete and it's going to lead to some problems.
Of course, because like you said, we don't scale. And you mentioned tension. And I like to focus on that because this is exactly what happens. It's like you have a rubber band and you are making more tension and more tension and more tension. And there's a point when it's good. There's a point where it keeps you fresh, where it keeps you thinking, it keeps you working, it keeps you in good motion. After that, or before that, you're not motivated. After that, there's too much tension and it can break anytime. When it breaks, it's going to hurt. So I think it was Aldo Rossi. He's an architectural thinker. He always spoke about the tension of different elements in the city. So for example, when you have the old city and the new city, there is a tension between the two. And there's a point where that tension is resolved. If you achieve that point of resolving the tension, the interaction between the old part and the new part will be a very healthy interaction. If you have too few tension, too little tension, or too much tension, what happens is one of the two is going to be strained. So you either strain the historic part of town or you strain the contemporary part of town. So you may have an old part of town that is dying and a new part of town that is sucking all the life from that. Or you may have a city that just doesn't walk or doesn't move because there's too little tension and the new part of town is just not being built. And there's a few houses scattered around, but then the downtown is not really being very vital or very dynamic. So the tension between the components of the city is a very important thing to look at and is a very delicate thing to balance because it needs to be in a specific point. So not too much stress, not too little stress.
How much of that difficulty in balancing is coming from a more municipal governance realm versus how much of that is more of in response to the public?
I think, again, it's a question of scale. I think, again, is if you have many neighborhoods, if you have a city of neighborhoods, these neighborhoods are going to be somewhat autonomous, even though they're not, but they're going to be somewhat autonomous. So the tension between the neighborhoods, the perfect point of tension between the neighborhoods will keep the city government responding to that. When there's not enough tension or there's too much tension between these different neighborhoods, or when the government is creating too much tension, I think the solutions start to not benefit everybody. I guess what I'm trying to say is when you have neighborhoods that have enough structure and enough connection between the scale of the neighborhood and the people who are inhabiting them, you can have these neighborhoods as living organisms, parts of a bigger system, which is the city. So when you have a good interaction between them, what you have is a healthy city. And what you have, how this manifests, is a healthy local government who doesn't create too much tension or doesn't relieve too much tension.
At the core of a lot of this is the value of placemaking, and that's pretty central to the work you're doing with Storefront Master. What exactly is placemaking and why is it so important?
There's many definitions of placemaking. Basically, I'll go with the definition of the Project for Public Spaces, which is a wonderful nonprofit that's out of New York City, been working for a long time now. they came up with this concept, I think probably 20 years ago or something like that. And the idea is that if you design a place, you are this architect or urban designer, what you will do is you will come to the place, you will look at the place, you will talk to a few people, you will go back to the office, and you make a wonderful drawing that somebody will build, and it will be a beautiful sculpture. But if you ditch that part and basically gather everybody that has a stake on that public space, people who use that public space, people who have businesses on that public space, real stakeholders of this public space, to bring their input, to bring their knowledge, to bring their ideas about what this place needs to be, then you create the best play, the best solution possible for that place to be successful and to serve the people who it needs to serve. So design is completely secondary to the interaction of the people creating the space together. So that is essentially placemaking. It's the process of creating solutions for public space that benefit everybody who has interaction with this public space. So yeah, there's the value of these places, I think, is that they are the cores of these units, of these neighborhoods that I was talking about before. So when you have good places in your neighborhood, these are the places where the good interactions between neighbors will happen. So when the structure of that neighborhood is strong, and the next one is also strong, and the next one is also strong, the interaction between neighborhoods will be healthy and also strong.
That notion of placemaking there, the way you explained, I think fits in really well with the earlier point on localized knowledge. For example, I could come in as a designer with quote unquote expert knowledge and a very impressive resume. Like you said, I could talk to a few people and be like, I know exactly what this community needs. And I put it down and put it out there. And then it's a massive open plaza that no one really cares much for.
Correct. Maybe alternatively, beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful in some sense, technically sound in some other way, but it's missing out on adding a lot of value. Where the alternative you're presenting is, it really is drawing in together all this local knowledge of the values and needs and the particular vernacular of the community, the architecture vernacular as
Correct.
Well, and guiding it with your expertise a little bit.
Exactly. And what it does, it multiplies the needs and desires of everyone who is contributing. So they don't add up, they multiply. Because when they are building it together, they are creating a bond between them and with the place. So this is the place that we built. The pride, the identity that's associated with this place makes everybody take care of the place. So they keep nourishing the relationship and they keep nourishing the place, which is, it's a never-ending cycle, basically.
So this idea of placemaking, how much of that is informed or, I guess, driven by local governing boards or municipal entities versus how much of that is driven by lay people, maybe that's local business owners or people who live in the neighborhood? What's that interplay between those two forces?
Whoever drives it needs to take off the hat and become one of the lay people. And as much influence as you can have to bring a huge placemaking project to your neighborhood, when you're sitting there, you have the exact same weight and voice that a child that rides his bike on the neighborhood can have. So when you take off your hat and you become the lay people who are designing what's going to happen in this place, not designing, but creating what's going to happen in this place, The creation of the place, the making of the place really has no, there's no difference who drives it. It begins when somebody's driving it, but then when they are creating, that someone needs to take off their hat.
Do you have a good sense as to how common these movements of placemaking are maybe across the United States or maybe even closer to your neck of the woods of the eastern seaboard of the United States? How common are these practices?
Becoming more common every day. And right now there's a huge global network. Placemaking X is the name of the people who are facilitating the global network. And they're, you know, uniting people from placemaking Europe, from placemaking India, from placemaking China, from placemaking Africa, from placemaking Latin America. So there's lots of channels of people who are who are using this philosophy of the community is the expert to create mm-hmm. places. And this is a grassroots movement, completely grassroots movement that, yeah, you may have a little bit more influence. And for example, one of the great placemaking projects that we did back home in Ecuador, it was driven by the municipality. So the vice mayor had the influence to bring the project for public spaces down to Quito and start the process with them. But the people who actually created the place were the locals. And the vice mayor, when she wanted to participate from these meetings, she could not go as the vice mayor. She had to go as a resident, as a citizen who her ideas had the same value of anybody else who was sitting around the table. So I guess that's a little bit of how it works. It's been growing a lot lately. And since it's a grassroots movement, it also accepts interactions with many other manifestations of the grassroots movement. For example, tactical urbanism. You might have heard of the tactical urbanism. These are interventions on streets and public spaces that the people can make. So you can go outside of your street and paint a bike lane. When you paint your bike lane and your neighbor also paints a bike lane and your next neighbor paints a bike lane, then you have three blocks of a great bike lane. It wasn't sanctioned by the city. It wasn't designed by the city. It didn't go through the engineers, nothing. It's just from one night to the next day, sun comes up and you see a bike lane on the street.
I don't know the legality of that. Is that there a legal pushback from cities against actions like that? Like a bunch of neighbors just saying, hey, we're going to create a bike lane. Let's all just paint down this strip of paint in front of the asphalt in front of our yards.
There may be, but it's a movement that's become so strong that now cities and corporations are hiring the guys who came up with this to come to their cities and do it. For example, the Times Square, the huge change of Times Square where they closed the, I think, two or three blocks of Broadway to create a wonderful public plaza, it started as a tactical urbanism initiative. So they just painted the floors, put some planters and put some chairs. Let's test it, see what happens. In some cases, it could be some sort of like a guerrilla urbanism in that mm-hmm. you bring your paint and the next day there's a bike lane, may or may not be illegal. It may be that when that happens, people start using it. And when the city comes and takes it out, that there's going to be a backlash for the mm-hmm. city. So, and this has happened. But generally, yeah, you need to get a permit. In most cities, you need to get a permit. You need to be conscious of what you're doing. But the things that have been done are just fantastic. Bringing children to paint the streets, having all the neighbors like have a huge block party in which they completely transform their street not only just painting the asphalt, but benches and trees and colors. It's just a fantastic movement.
I want to go back to since the beginning of COVID. What changes have you seen in regards to placemaking happening? Because with COVID, people have been going outdoors more than we were before, and it will be a big challenge. I know I'm going to be feeling it with winter rolling in and us being locked inside. But what improvements or what has placemaking been looking like during COVID from what you've seen?
I think the experimentation, the hope of being able to use our streets for pedestrians and bikes has given the movement a lot of strength. So if you go, I don't know, streets everywhere, basically, in everywhere, China, in Europe, here in the US, in South America, everywhere, you go to the principal streets of the cities, and at least half of them are closed so that restaurants and maybe even markets can be on the streets with proper distancing. So we have taken back so many of urban streets from the exclusive mm-hmm. use of the car to transform them into people's spaces, people places. It has given a lot of people a lot of hope. And if the principal street of the city gives that kind of hope, there's lots of echoes of that in neighborhoods and in smaller towns. So yeah, I think placemakers are being empowered right now by what's happening.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of critics of car-centric culture and car-centric cities who have been really hopeful, like you said, about a lot of cafes and markets, etc., moving out into the streets, reclaiming the streets from the cars. And with enough time, as this pandemic has gone on, people are becoming a bit more accustomed to having that there. And I think you're right that once we get more of a firm grapple with COVID and can move beyond that, maybe people will be accustomed to say, nope, you can't take these back. We want our sidewalks, our storefronts, and our streets to be like this.
That would be the ideal, the ideal situation. But then, okay, it's still happening. So things are not back to normal by any means. And people are working still from home. We don't know if there's going to be a trend of returning to the office. We have seen a little bit of it. You could read it both ways. The trends that you see right now, you can read both ways. Some people are going back, some people are never going back. So the traveling, the commuting that essentially made up a very large part of urban living, at least in the US, is not present. But we don't know if that's going to return. So there are a few things that we can do. The infrastructure for remote working is still lacking a little bit. Apple just launched their 5G phones. And that, I guess, is going to be the beginning of the 5G revolution. And it's really a revolution, because the speed and the breadth of interactions that you can have with going from 4G to 5G is just exponential. It's incredible, the things that you can do now, or you could do now. Doctors operating remotely, dentists operating remotely, people building airplanes remotely. So you can have your Boeing operators in the comfort of their homes with a joystick, and they are actually making the plane in the plant. Those are the things that 5G will enable. So we still don't know what's going to happen. What I do see, so before they would go to the office and they would go have lunch in a restaurant that was close to the office. Mm-hmm. Right now they're going to be patronizing a local restaurant, a local diner in whatever small town they choose to live in. So the ring of the social living is going to be local, even though they are still inserted in the global network. So I call them the concentric rings of the post-pandemic rings, if you want. Mm-hmm. You will have your local life in a slightly smaller area that you can cover by walking, that you can cover by and that your supply chain can also cover easily. So the milk may be local, the meat may be local, the convenience, many things can be local. Your social life will be local, but then you'll be working for, I don't know, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, which is in China, but you are in small town in Washington State.
It sounds like you're painting a bit of a picture, and that there's a tension there between the local and the global. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, how can we get the benefits of both? Maybe it's asking to have it both ways. It sounds like what you're painting here might offer an avenue of being able to have the benefits of both, that those things that really do best at scaling up, such as maybe an airplane factory somewhere else, like every state or town doesn't need an airplane mm-hmm. factory, but those things that really can be anywhere and locally, such as your food, for example, that could be a big shift. But it seems there might be a way to have a bit of the benefits on both sides.
I think we need to work hard. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, right now we don't know what's going to happen yet, because you could read the trends either way. But then the people who are doing it right now, they may be the pioneers. They may work hard to find a way to have both. And I believe technology is allowing us to do that now. And I believe that it's impossible at this point in history, with the technology that we have and with the types of goods that we have, computers, even pencils, it's impossible to make a pencil locally. Because unless you have a graphite mine and a forest and a rubber trees or plastic or petroleum or whatever refinery, you probably cannot make a pencil. And so I think it's naive to think that you can go completely local right now. If you go local, there's trade-offs. There will have to be trade-offs. So if we keep both concentric rings working at the same time, the local and the global, I think we can find the solution. So I think there is a way of making it, but we need to work hard.
Who are some of the strongest or best critics to these efforts to focus on local placemaking? What are the arguments that people have to push back against all these placemaking networks of people who are involved in the similar type of work you're doing? Who's pushing back against you? To me, I was like, this sounds wonderful. Who's going to oppose this? But who are the forces that are opposing it?
The thing is, it's very hard to oppose something that is not being created from above. So there is no one who is managing this placemaking network. There's no one who is dictating the playbook of the placemaking network. So if you break the network in, I don't know, let's say you break the California placemaking network, it will be back with the same force or more in no time, because there is no way to break this network made of so many grassroots movements that are just coming together. So I guess you can oppose, but there comes a time when people are doing things that are, number one, not illegal and they are free to do, when people are getting together and making decisions about their immediate surroundings and even using their property. There's nothing you can do about it. You may not like it, but there's nothing you can do about it. So the stronger a network is, I believe, when it's made up of smaller networks, which are also made up of smaller networks, which are also made up of smaller networks. So I think that is the strength of the global placemaking network.
Jaime, you paint a compelling, but I think balanced and candid picture of what some of these trends may look like. So I appreciate you coming on the show, telling us a little bit about your work and placemaking, and best of luck in your efforts.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.